Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Monday, April 6, 2026. I'm your son, Sounds of Arizona, volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli. The featured photo on today's cover page is of some women in very colorful dresses. They appear to be dancing. The caption reads, Arizona Commissioner on the Arts, Willena Ortega Center, Bird Dances with Others, March 14th. During the bird dancing and singing competition during the Mulchata Fair and Rodeo in Sacaton, Arizona. The accompanying article is titled, Given to Our People to Bring Us Together. Bird Singers Tell History of Native Southwest People by Deborah Utitia Kroll. Adolph Hodge, Riley Carlisle, and Dusty Yazzie, all members of the Colorado River Tribes, competed for top honors on March 14th during the 61st annual Mulchata Fair and Rodeo in the Gila River Indian Community. The trio joined dozens of other singers and dancers who came from as far as San Diego, Needles, and Palm Springs to celebrate one of the Southwest's most enduring traditions, bird singing. Men and boys as young as one-year-old Francisco Rodriguez III, a peeposh from Gila River, wielded rattles, crafted from dried gourds and filled with palm tree seeds to celebrate the distinctive tss-tss sounds. Handles of willow, cottonwood, or ocotillo are attached. After construction, the gourds are painted with bright colors, some depicting various clam symbols or tribal motifs. Women and girls don't sing, and said they dance to the songs. They're often barefoot, which they say means a direct connection to the earth. It also helps them maintain balance and grounding as they dance, sometimes mimicking birds moving on the ground. They wear regalia particular to their tribe and featuring long, flowing skirts with ribbons, circling or sewn in patterns reflecting our clan's intricately hand-beaded collar capes and filmy scarves. These songs are the original songs, tribal songs, said Raul Christman, a member of the Viejas band Ocumaye Indians. He traveled from San Diego to serve as master of ceremonies at the Gila River event. The traditional songs range from the southern and Baja California coasts over the mountains and across the Mojave and Sonoran deserts to central and northern Arizona. They are the oral history of our people. For the human people, for all the tribes that are human language speakers, he said. The songs differ slightly between the human-speaking peoples, which include the Kumeyaay, Kichkan, Kokopa, Mojave, Peeposh, and the Pai tribes, and the Kahila, Serrano, and Chimicjevi. They are meant to teach people similar lessons. They tell the journey of people and families moving through life about indigenous people's journey as they migrated from one location to another, Christman said. And they have songs to explain the journey from this world to the next. The songs belong to all the peoples, Christman said. I've been singing now for 40-plus years, he said. I've been singing almost my entire life. Christman's family, including his father, relatives on his mother's side, and all over the generations, all sing. I started when I was a little guy. Barely walking, I was singing. Bird songs made a comeback in the 1970s. Bird songs are passed down the generations with sons, grandsons, and nephews learning from their older members, while women and girls learn the dance moves and how to craft regalia from their female elders. During a big event like a funeral or gathering, multiple bird singer groups will trade off for all-night sessions. Like other traditions in Indian country, bird singing suffered a decline due to several factors, including the influence of boarding schools, the need to obtain jobs in the mainstream, and the struggle to build igamis and tribal communities in the post-World War II era. In the 1970s, alarmed that few men were making gourd rattles or women were learning the dances that accompany the songs, Cochila and elder Serrano bird singers Anthony Andreas, Robert Levi, Avino Silva, and Michael Mireles worked to reclaim the heritage. They were joined by Silva's nephew Ernest, an entomologist and culture bearer from the Morongo Band of Mission Indians to revitalize the songs. Soon, bird singing resurged, and now social events, competitions, and gatherings across the region all feature the regional tradition. In recent years, powwows and rodeos in Southern California and the Southwest host bird singing events just as they had until the advent of World War II. Song, dance, and cultural sharing. After the Tiny Tot competition, where all the diminutive ones were won goodie bags, the women and girls danced at the Mul-Cha-Ta bird singing competition. Chrisman and other bird singers sang while dancers ranging from 6 to more than 65 put their best feet, skirts, and moves forward. While waiting for the men and the boys to show their best rhythms and voices, the Parker boys told the Arizona Republic why they sang. "We're here to learn about our country," said Hugh, 18. Carlisle, just 12, said he was interested in cultural pursuits. "We like the rhythm of the dance," the seventh grader said. "Whatever comes up, we're there." Yazzie, the senior of the group at 37, said that he enjoyed seeing different people from different tribes. "Each culture is different from ours," he said, "and some groups sing different songs. But we did all right, given to our people to bring us together." There was a bit of excitement when the judges called a dance-off in the women's 20 to 40 category between ladies from Fort Yuma and Peach Springs. The two women gave it their all, displaying their bird dance skills as Chrisman and the other bird singers sang. After all the competitors had a chance to showcase their best move, social dancing commenced. Two Keachin Elder bird singers, including Chris Emerson, led other bird singers while the judges tallied their ballots. "I'm glad to see younger people doing it," said Emerson, who declined to state his age. "These songs of harvest and little bird songs provide guidance which keeps us in touch." Emerson said the songs heard at Mul-Cha-Ta are different than would be heard at serious events like funerals. He said the skirts and ribbon shirts originated from the days when cotton appeared in communities and in the Indian boarding schools. The ribbons, he said, reflected a person's wealth, and the diamonds in many capes and skirts reflect the four directions. The Parker boys won second place in the men's group category. Soon, they said, they would sing at the next event on the unofficial bird singer calendar, the Mega Throw in their hometown of Parker. Other events were listed on a Facebook page devoted to bird singing and dancing. "Today we came together and share those similarities with one another, to see old friends, to make new ones, and to really just enjoy bird song and dance," Chrisman told the crowd at the cultural circle tucked into the northern part of Mul-Cha-Ta Fairgrounds. "It's something that was given to our people to bring us together." Deborah Kroll reports on indigenous communities at the confluence of climate, culture, and commerce in Arizona and the Intermountain West. Reach Kroll at debra.krol@azcentral.com. We have an article titled, "Hobbs Energy Task Force Outlines Its Plans, Looks to Meet Demand from Data Centers While Managing Costs," by Stacy Bartschinger. An energy task force convened by Governor Katie Hobbs has outlined plans to expedite new projects to meet demand from data centers and Arizona's semiconductor boom while keeping the costs of doing so from driving up Arizonans' utility bills. "We have this really big issue of needing to plan strategically for our energy future, and really, the future of Arizona depends on that," Hobbs said. "The goal is to make sure that we can meet the energy demands that are allowing us to continue to create opportunity for Arizonans in high-paying, high-tech jobs and keeping the energy affordable for everyday Arizonans who are already struggling right now," she said. The task force delivered its final report and 31 broad recommendations to Hobbs on April 2nd. The recommendations are a to-do list for the months and years ahead. Many will require other groups and elected regulators, including the Arizona Corporation Commission, to take action. The recommendations include ending the state's tax incentive for data centers, which Hobbs had previously backed, while suggesting new incentives for nuclear power generation. The governor established the Arizona Energy Promise Task Force in a September executive order. It was made up of 36 government officials, higher education leaders, utility company executives, environmental and renewable energy advocates, economic groups, and representatives of private industry. The membership was broad to build buy-in for the non-binding recommendations. "Many people here, many name tags, are used to disagreeing with each other in very public forums, and this was a forced moment to sit together and say, Where do we agree? Where do we disagree? And where can we find opportunity for collaboration? Ricky Segan, Executive Director of the InterWest Energy Alliance, told Hobbs and the task force presented its recommendations at the state capitol's executive tower. The alliance represents large-scale renewable energy developers. Segan highlighted the task force recommendations for a central permitting council. If established, the council would bring together government officials whose jurisdiction play a role in permitting or approving energy projects to serve as a single point of contact for developers. The report recommends expediting state-issued permits as much as possible and mapping potential development sites on state land. Diane Brown, Executive Director of the Arizona Public Interest Research Group, praised a recommendation for a statewide public education campaign. Brown said that could help Arizonans cut their energy bills and save money and raise awareness of programs that can help families pay their utility bills. The report also calls for developing an energy and energy efficiency workforce training program that engages rural and tribal communities. In particular, it favors renewable energy sources like wind and solar, proposes cutting red tape that can hold up those projects, and aims to establish Arizona as a fertile ground for geothermal power generation. The task force report recommends using federal funds to finance any new nuclear projects and explore state incentives to reduce upfront costs. The federal government is looking to accelerate more nuclear energy, and I think that's obviously there's safety concerns, environmental concerns, that we have to make sure we're attending to. But we're absolutely making sure Arizona is part of those conversations, Hobbs said. We are not in a position where we can pick winners and losers in the energy space, Hobbs said. We have to have an all-of-the-above approach. While some politicians on the left have largely incorporated similar language into their vocabulary, it has more frequently been used by Republicans to address how to approach a looming energy crisis. An all-of-the-above energy strategy was an explicit part of the GOP's national platform in 2016, as well as the late Senator John McCain's 2008 campaign for president. Within the report are some notable areas of alignment with the Trump administration, such as encouraging geothermal generation and nuclear power production. But President Donald Trump administration has doubled down on fossil fuels, too, pushing for coal production while attacking wind and solar projects. Data center incentives create division. The report supports the Arizona Corporation Commission's review of how data centers and the energy grid operate and calls for more research on what other states are doing to encourage data centers and other large users to generate their own energy. It also recommends that developers of data centers and other major users work with residents, a collaboration that could avoid contentious council meetings that have taken place in Chandler and Tucson. Nick Myers, the Republican chair of the Corporation Commission, said the report offered a serious look at the state's energy needs and supported commission policies. The commission will continue to work with the governor's office and all interested stakeholders on ensuring that growth pays for growth in the energy sector and that Arizona is a state of choice for continued energy infrastructure as well as for the people and businesses that support and benefit from it, Myers said in a statement. While the recommendations were largely consensus-driven, there was some disagreement. Representatives of tech giants Microsoft, Google, and the Data Center Coalition, an industry lobbying group, objected to Hobbs' proposal to eliminate a state tax incentive for data centers, according to the report. The incentives cost Phoenix taxpayers over $12 million a year in revenue, according to a recent audit backed by Mayor Kate Gallego, who has pushed back on the center development. Gallego was a member of the task force. The jobs report recognizes that data centers are a key part of Arizona's economy and a source of good jobs, particularly when the warehouses are under construction. We want to continue that economic investment, of course, Maren Mahoney, Director of Hobbs Office of Resiliency Task Force Chair, said in an interview. There's a balance that needs to be struck. The report recommends making sure that communities feel they are empowered and they have resources so they can engage and attract those developments, and then they can attract investments in a way that is productive and constructive, she said. Transparency and ensuring growth pays for growth are the abiding principles. Long-term solutions to a power problem. The governor recognized her power here is in convening and building up that consensus and the planning, Maloney said. Different organizations are going to have to take them up. The task force recommended urgent action on divisive policy areas where solutions can take years and span administrations. Homs, a Democrat, is up for re-election this November. One of the leading Republican opponents, Representative Andy Biggs, Republican of Arizona, has supported fossil fuel power generation and President Donald Trump's rollback of environmental regulations. Two of the five members of the Corporation Commission, currently made entirely of Republicans, are also on the ballot. The work of this task force is really about the long term and the longevity, and there is recognition that no matter what happens in this building, that we're committed to Arizona's future, and that's not just about who's governor, Hobbs said. It's about the people driving the energy future. I think there is commitment to move forward regardless of the politics involved. Reach reporter Stacey Bartschenger at stacey.bartschenger at arizonapublic.com or 480-416-5669. We finished today's front page with an article titled Arizona Might Block Teenagers from Using Social Media by Taylor Seeley. As state and federal juries issued landmark verdicts in March holding social media companies liable for harming minors, Arizona lawmakers were considering how to protect kids here. The concern over social media's detrimental effects on mental health, bullying, self-harm, and sleep disruption runs so deep that both Republicans and Democrats at the state capitol appear open to banning social media for teenagers under 15 without parental permission. Lawmakers have proposed two methods so far. They have also considered requiring age verification for websites and apps with a substantial amount of conduct considered harmful to minors, a legal term with criteria that is supposed to limit kids' access to certain material while also balancing educational and artistic value. But while surveys and polls show most American parents support policies to limit and rein in kids' social media use, laws doing so have faced repeated legal challenges for violating the First Amendment. AIDS verification and banning kids' access to social media can impose burdens on adults' constitutional speech rights. Civil liberty groups and constitutional law scholars have warned that different interpretations of harmful to minors could sweep in and chill protected expression. Opponents of the Arizona legislation say it threatens data security, undermines online anonymity, and could lead to privacy invasive questions to confirm parental consent. Jose Torres of TechNet, a trade group representing companies like Google, Meta, and Netflix, told lawmakers at a Senate Regulatory Affairs and Government Efficiency Committee meeting in February that custody issues could complicate verifying parental consent, for example. A spokesperson for Meta said the proposed new law would send teens to less regulated sites that are more dangerous. But a recent case at the U.S. Supreme Court could indicate an opening for those regulations, and the bill sponsors, Senator Shauna Bullock, Republican of Phoenix, and Representative Michael Carbone, Representative of Buckeye, appear to have put the prospect of legal challenges at the center of their efforts. The intent here is to do it the right way, Carbone told House members in March. A month earlier, he said he was being purposeful and deliberate, working with stakeholders and lawmakers across the aisle to get something across that we can all agree on and will hold up in a constitutional manner. Bipartisan support has happened as a result. Two Democrats joined Republicans in the Senate to pass Bullock's bill, and more than half of House Democrats joined Republicans to approve Carbone's bill. The bills are identical, but haven't made their way to the governor's desk. Changes to the legislation are expected. A strong bipartisan support, coupled with Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs' passage of an age verification law for pornographic websites last year from Representative Nick Cupper, Republican of Surprise, could indicate the teen ban has a shot at becoming law. Hobbs' office declined to comment on the legislation. how Arizona would restrict social media for teenagers. The social media restrictions in House Bill 2991 and Senate Bill 1747 have undergone several changes in the last month, and more could come. The latest version of the bill said both app stores and individual app developers would need to secure parental consent for kids 15 and younger. It would put the onus on the app store to determine users' age. App developers would have to provide certain safeguards and parental controls for accounts held by minors. Some include allowing parents to set kids' daily time limits on the app, preventing kids from sending their geolocation to other users, and other controls for who and how they engage with others. Companies that violated the rules could face civil lawsuits from minors or their parents for actual damages or $1,000 per violation, whichever is bigger, plus punitive damages if this violation was egregious. The Attorney General could seek a civil penalty of $75,000 per violation. Carbone and Bullock declined interview requests from the Arizona Republic. Both said they would talk after all the details were sorted out. What the bill's age verification requirement would do. The bill's age verification requirement would, 1. Require standard or anonymous age verification if a substantial portion of the app's content is harmful to minors. It does not specify what counts as substantial. 2. Prevent people younger than 18 from accessing material harmful to minors. 3. Ensure third-party anonymous age verification companies don't store personally identifying information after the age has been verified and don't use the information for any other purpose. Court decision pending for Florida law, Arizona's bill modeled after. At least 17 states have passed laws reining in social media access for minors as of February 2026, according to the Age Verification Providers Association. Many of those requiring parental consent for teen usage were challenged in court and are facing injunctions, which are court orders, preventing their enforcement. The proposed Arizona ban was modeled after Florida's House Bill 3, which bars anybody under 16 from using some social media programs, except for 14 and 15-year-olds who obtained parental permission. Associations representing platforms like Google, YouTube, Meta, and Snapchat filed a federal lawsuit immediately after Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed it into law in 2024, saying it limits users' access to certain content lawfully protected by the First Amendment. The First Amendment protects speech unless it falls into certain categories. Federal courts have held that some material can be protected for minors, but not adults. When that's the case, states can restrict kids' access, but not that of adults. While a federal district judge said Florida's law was likely unconstitutional, two federal appeals court judges disagreed. A decision is pending at the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, where oral arguments were heard March 10th. The U.S. Supreme Court's 2025 case, Free Speech Coalition v. Paxton, which upheld a Texas law requiring age verification for pornographic websites, has paved the way for lawmakers to propose additional policies that infringe on adults' free speech rights when the intent is protecting children. Stephanie Matant, First Amendment reporter at the Tallahassee Democrat, contributed to this story. Taylor Seeley is a First Amendment reporting fellow at the Arizona Republic and ACCentral.com. Do you have a story about government infringing on your First Amendment rights? Reach her at tseely@arizonarepublic.com or by phone at 480-476-6116. Seeley's role is funded through a collaboration between the Freedom Forum and Journalism Funding Partners. Funders do not provide editorial input. Before we head to the Valley and State page, let me remind you that you can listen to our programs on our website. Go to sunsounds.org. Click the link labeled Broadcast, Info, and Audio. On the left side of the page, you'll see a box labeled Programming Links, with a link to listen live, as well as a link for on-demand programs. The featured photo on today's cover page is of Will.i.am. The caption reads, Will I Am, professor of practice, speaks to members of the media at Arizona State University in Tempe on April 1st. The Black Eyed Peas frontman began teaching a course in artificial intelligence at the start of this year. The accompanying article is titled, Inside Will I Am's ASU Class on AI. Top priority was grounding lessons in ethical use by Helen Rummel. The week before, musician Will.i.am was set to teach his first ever college course at Arizona State University, his mouth started to get dry. That was the most nervous week I ever had to go through in my life, he said. I remember preparing for the Super Bowl. That wasn't that daunting, Will.i.am said. Preparing to teach at ASU, that was like, oh my gosh, what did I sign up for? The Black Eyed Peas frontman began teaching a 15-week general elective course in artificial intelligence at the start of this year. From his Hollywood studio, students learned everything from the basics of AI to creating their own personal automated agents. His new assignment as a professor shook him, he said. Will.i.am is comfortable in front of crowds, noting that he can't see the faces of people watching. Becoming face-to-face with students would be entirely different. To combat his first day of school jitters, Will.i.am called his mom. He said he was afraid of having students who were so knowledgeable about AI that he wouldn't be able to guide them effectively or answer their questions. In response, his mom asked, What would you do if you were on stage? That moment came quickly, with students peppering him with questions about where the AI industry was headed and how corporations were wielding their influence. The AI course spans a wide range of fast-moving technologies. Students have heard from a list of prominent guest speakers, including the head of ChatGPT and the chief executive officer of Microsoft AI. Will.i.am said his top priority was grounding his lessons in the ethical use of AI, noting that regulations lag far behind the industry. What's scary now is how fast it's moving, he said. What's scary now is how unprepared the adults are to make sure we're safe. ASU class laid a step in AI influence for musical icon. Will.i.am has been in the artificial intelligence space for several years and launched his own AI-driven creative platform called FYI.ai in 2020. He's involved in several AI leadership groups, including the United Nations AI Skills Coalition and several committees at the World Economic Forum. The course is titled The Agentic Self and guides nearly 80 students through the use of agentic AI. The technology allows a person to use AI to take on various tasks on their behalf. Students create their own agents in the class, which can act as representatives for them and even mirror their personalities and skills. If you choose to make it like an example of your imagination, that's still a part of you, Will.i.am said. It still came from you. Students choose their agents for a variety of causes, including one who trained it to call her mom on the phone and guide her through everyday life. Another student in the course, Dhruv Patel, described the energetic feeling he and his colleagues had toward the trajectory of AI and what it would mean for their futures. Patel said he was focused on creating meaningful change in the industry. There's a blatant and rampant positivity going around this tech, Patel said of his class. And I think I look at it in a similar way. I look at it as augmentation instead of automation. Students from a variety of backgrounds are studying under the musician, ranging from students in their late teens and another in their 60s. Several students are enrolled in the course virtually. They're equal in the classroom, and it's beautiful, Will.i.am said. Will.i.am hopes to expand AI education to the masses. Another ASU course taught by Will.i.am has already been scheduled, with future partnerships between the school and the musician expected. But outside of that, Will.i.am said he wants to bring real-world AI skills to the people who likely need it the most. Will.i.am envisions sharing his education-focused AI platform with community college districts and other community-based schools to fight against the potential replacement of workers with automated AI. What jobs are going to be available when people graduate, he asked. Academia is threatened right now. As for his first ever cohort, Will.i.am said his memories will stick with him for years to come, recalling an electricity from the classroom. I know. It changed my life, he said. Because I want to do it again. I love it. Helen Rummel will cover state politics and higher education for the Arizona Republic. Reach her at HRUMMEL@azcentral.com. This is Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Monday, April 6, 2026. I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli. You can listen to Sun Sounds on your smart home device, such as an Amazon Echo or Google Home. Simply ask the device to play Sun Sounds of Arizona. We turn back to political news with an article titled, Arizona Sues to Stop Trump Mail-In Voting Order by Stacey Bartschinger and Ronald J. Hansen. Arizona has sued to block President Donald Trump's order limiting voting by mail to citizens verified by his administration, arguing the March directive illegally interferes with the state's 35-year-old mail-in voting law. The case was filed April 3rd in U.S. District Court in Massachusetts by a coalition of 23 states. The coalition requests a ruling reaffirming that elections are managed by states, not the federal government. The Constitution is absolutely clear. States run their elections, Attorney General Chris Mays, a Democrat, said in a statement, not the president, and Arizona will not allow the federal government to seize control of our elections. The case seeks to draw another legal line against the Trump administration's efforts to shape the 2026 midterm elections. Mays, suing on behalf of Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes, a Democrat, is already battling the White House over an early request for the state's voter files. Separately, the FBI has subpoenaed records of the state Senate-ordered recount of Maricopa County's 2020 ballots as part of an ongoing criminal investigation that also involves Georgia. In the latest case, the states argue the Trump administration cannot force them to comply, especially with procedures that contradict state laws on voter registration and voting by mail. They argue that enacting Trump's changes ahead of the November midterm elections would require a rushed pace that could create confusion or disenfranchise voters. The president's order lays bare a scheme to intimidate and coerce state officials into removing voters who do not appear on the federal government's list, regardless of the accuracy or reliability of those lists, the lawsuit said. The federal screening intended by Trump's executive order includes at least some features already present in Arizona's vote-by-mail system. The state has for years required documentary proof of citizenship at registration and already uses a unique barcode intended to ensure the ballots involve only those properly registered to vote. Arizona has employed mail-in voting for more than 100 years. The practice began for those who were expected to be unavailable on election day or had physical limitations. In 1991, the state began expanding the option of mail-in voting to the general public. In Arizona, voters will begin casting ballots in about 3 months for the July 21st primary election. The greatest threat to the safety and security of our elections is Donald Trump continuing to lie about them, Fontes said in a statement. Arizona elections are run by Arizonans, our neighbors, our friends, and our family. This latest attack on vote by mail and voter privacy is a direct attack not just on our voters, but on our election administrators who work day in and day out to keep democracy running. At least two other lawsuits have been filed across the nation challenging Trump's mail-in mandate. Those cases were brought by voting rights organizations and Democratic leaders in Congress and affiliated groups. Apart from authorities in Arizona and Massachusetts, the state's cases involved attorneys general in California, Nevada, and Washington, along with 18 other states in Washington, D.C., joining in. It is the 40th case against the Trump administration that Mays has filed or joined since voters elected Trump for a second term in 2024. We turn to an article by Elena Santa Cruz titled, Report Shows How ICE Facility Caught Fire. Investigator describes the suspect as a man. Someone hid a propane tank in the bushes next to an ICE-owned property in Surprise about an hour before using it to break a window and try to set the building on fire, according to a Surprise Police Department report. Authorities have yet to arrest anyone in connection with the February 21st criminal damage to the warehouse off Sweetwater Avenue and Dysart Road. But the surprise police report details how the crime was planned after completing its own preliminary investigation before turning the case over to the FBI and the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives because the damage occurred on federal property. The incident took place nearly 1 month after the U.S. Department of Homeland Security quietly purchased the warehouse from Rockefeller Group for over $70 million. ICE had planned for it to be a 1,500-bed center for prosecuting immigrant detainees, but that number has since been slashed to about 550. The ICE facility has been a point of controversy for the suburban city, where many have called on the city council to take a stronger stand against it. The building is near schools, neighborhoods, restaurants, stores, and entertainment centers. It may also sit in a chemical hazard zone, according to the liberal activist group Northwest Valley Indivisible. Brent Peek, the group's go-chair, said that the facility's existence has already attracted violence, including the criminal damage to the building, which he said the group condemned. The attack forced federal authorities to be at the facility sooner than expected to keep a consistent watch on the property, he said. We didn't want to see anything happen that would bring ICE here any sooner, said Peek on March 30th. Alarm trigger police, fire response to the surprise facility. The ICE facility was not yet in operation when it was targeted on February 21st. Public safety personnel were alerted when a representative with Metro Fire and Security, a fire protection company, called 911 after 1 a.m. Sprinklers and a fire alarm were going off in the building, according to the call obtained by the Arizona Republic through a public records request. The dispatcher left a voicemail with the reporting party a few minutes later to share that a fire alarm was going off in the southwest corner. When firefighters arrived, they called police. They suspected the building was vandalized and reported broken glass, a fire, and a propane tank that had to be sealed, according to the police report obtained by the Republic, also through a public records request. Police investigators reported they noticed a shattered window, a burnt curtain, burnt charcoal, and a large propane bottle. The fire damaged some carpet and drywall. Investigators collected multiple pieces of evidence from the site, including a bottle of what smelled like lighter fluid and a buzzball alcoholic drink that still had some liquid in it, the report said. Suspect damages ICE facility about an hour after hiding items. Police detailed in the report what surveillance footage shows. The vehicle pulls into the parking lot on the southwest side of the warehouse around 12 a.m. on February 21st. The investigator describes the suspect as a man. The driver parks, pulls items out of his vehicle, walks toward the building, and places the objects between bushes near the front of the facility. He returns to his vehicle and leaves, driving north along Dysart Road, the report said. He returns on foot about 30 minutes later and recovers the items from the bushes. He peeks into the facility before trying and failing to break the doors with an unknown object, and then smashes windows with an unknown object. He works to break out the glass, including with a propane tank. At about 1:05 a.m., the man starts a fire outside the window with what appears to be a box containing charcoal. Then he throws the box and the propane tank inside the building. A minute later, he leaves and is no longer visible on camera. Kevin Smith, a spokesperson for the FBI, would not disclose any details of the ongoing case. Elena Santa Cruz covers the West Valley cities of Glendale, Surprise, and Peoria. Feature at elena.santacruz@arizonarepublic.com. Next is a story titled Interior Seeks to Revoke Drilling Ban at Chaco Canyon by Orlissa D. Vicente. The Interior Department is looking to revoke protections surrounding Chaco Cultural National Historical Park with a proposal to rescind Public Land Order 7923, which puts wide area of land around the park off limits to mining and drilling. Former Interior Secretary Deb Haaland announced in June 2023 the withdrawal of more than 336,400 acres of public land from mining and drilling, creating a 10-mile buffer around the park for 20 years. Revoking that action would return discretion over mineral leasing to the Bureau of Land Management and reopen the land to new claims and development. The mineral withdrawal was developed through an extensive public process that spanned a year and a half and included 150 days for public comment. Now, however, the Department of the Interior is fast-tracking its proposed rollback, with only a 7-day review period giving the public until April 7th to leave a comment. Park advocates were disappointed by the administration's move. Chaco Canyon is one of the most extraordinary cultural landscapes in our national park system, and has endured as a place of community and connection that continues to hold profound meaning for tribes today, the National Parks Conservation Association said in a statement. Now, the Trump administration is auctioning it off to the oil and gas industry, trading sacred and scenic vistas for pump jacks and the drum of drilling. Lawsuit divides tribes surrounding the park. Although revoking of the buffer zone would not be welcomed by the Pueblo tribes fighting to protect Chaco Canyon, it could be considered as a victory for Navajo Nation leaders. A few days after President Donald Trump took office in 2025, Navajo tribal leaders filed a complaint in a New Mexico federal court, arguing the Interior Department's plan to withdraw land from new oil and gas leasing violated the law and could cost land allocatees millions of dollars in royalties. The National Congress of American Indians passed a resolution in June 2025 urging action to restart efforts to protect Chaco Canyon and the public land surrounding it, and to pass the Chaco Cultural Heritage Area Protection Act, which would create a permanent 10-mile buffer zone around the site, restricting oil, gas, and mineral extraction. The Navajo Nation's lawsuit was dismissed March 31st without prejudice. The dismissal follows settlement between the Navajo Nation and the federal government. The Pueblos of the Acoma and Laguna were not parties to that agreement and are not bound by its terms, and have not waived any rights or claims about any future effort to revoke or weaken these protections, according to the dismissal. Pueblos of Acoma and Laguna tribes are named as defendant interveners in the lawsuit. The dismissal did not decide the merits of whether the Chaco withdrawal should stay in place, the Pueblo tribe said in a statement. What remains clear is that the federal government is continuing a process that could affect one of the most significant cultural landscapes in North America. That process must be lawful, transparent, and must be carried out in full recognition of the federal government's trust responsibility to the Pueblos and tribes whose history, identity, and living cultural traditions remain tied to Chaco Canyon and the greater Chaco landscape. Pueblo tribes seek further assurances. The United States has promised the Navajo Nation that it will complete consultation and environmental protection and compliance associated with revoking Public Land Order 7923 and to issue a decision within 90 days of March 26, 2026, unless that deadline is later extended by agreement. The settlement commitment is between the parties, not a court-ordered deadline. The compressed time frame heightens the need for serious and legally adequate process, officials said. The dismissal of this case does not resolve fundamental concerns of the Pueblo of Acoma, said Governor Charles Riley of the Pueblo of Acoma. Acoma was not a party to the settlement. The United States cannot use this private agreement as a shortcut around its independent duties to engage in meaningful tribal consultation, comply with NEPA and other applicable laws, and fully account for the cultural, historical, and spiritual significance of the greater Chaco landscape. The Pueblos called on the Department of the Interior and Bureau of Land Management to hold meaningful government-to-government consultation and to fully explain the legal, cultural, and environmental basis for any proposed action. The Pueblos also want a complete, credible NEPA review that examines impacts to cultural landscapes, sacred places, traditional uses, and Pueblo interests. The Pueblo of Laguna remains deeply concerned about how decisions affecting the greater Chaco region are being made, said Governor Harry A. Antonio of the Pueblo of Laguna. Revoking these protections cannot come at the expense of cultural ties or through shortcuts that sidestep meaningful consultation and thorough review. Arlissa D. Bencetti covers Indigenous Affairs for the Arizona Republic and AZCentral.com. Send story ideas and tips to arlyssa.bencenti@arizonarepublic.com. Next, Arizona Politicians Offer Solutions for High Gas Prices by Jose R. Gonzalez and Stacy Bartschinger. Arizona gas prices remain high, and those running for governor each has a different solution in mind. As of April 3rd, rounded to the nearest cent, the average price of regular gasoline was $4.70 in Arizona, according to AAA. The federal government has taken action to ease the strain on consumers at the pump. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lee Zeldin granted a national waiver March 25th to alleviate supply shortages that could help lower per-gallon prices. Voters in Arizona may take their wallet worries to the ballot. Candidates vying for the executive tower at the state capitol complex have each expressed different ways they want to lower gas prices. Governor Hobbs weighs feasibility of lifting gas tax. In March, Democratic incumbent Katie Hobbs requested a federal air quality standards waiver on Arizona's fuel blend requirements. She also said she would consider waiving the state's 18 cents per gallon gas tax. "I think we can't take anything off the table, but I do recognize the gas tax is a very complicated issue," Hobbs told reporters March 27th. The gas tax funds roads projects, with Arizona netting $533 million in gas tax revenues for the last full fiscal year, according to the Arizona Department of Transportation. "Any tax holiday," Hobbs said, "must be approved during budget negotiations with the legislature and be done by July 1st. Gubernatorial candidates push for more oil refinery. Representative Andy Biggs, Republican of Arizona, who is the frontrunner in the GOP primary, has supported Trump's plan for domestic refineries and called for one in Arizona. Another GOP candidate, David Schweikert, said he is pushing for long-term supply solutions and urged President Donald Trump in a March 20th letter to increase oil refining in California, which supplies gas to Arizona. Schweikert said a gas tax holiday fell short of a permanent solution given Arizona's reliance on gasoline from other states. Stephanie Inez brings us an article titled, "Highly Mutated Cicada COVID Strain Has Yet to Be Detected in Arizona." A COVID-19 virus strain, nicknamed Cicada, that may evade immunity from vaccines and past infection, has been detected in 25 states, but not in Arizona. "We don't have any evidence of it. I won't say it's not here," said David Engelthayer, who is the executive director of the Health Observatory at Arizona State University. ASU's Health Observatory, the state health department, and other entities in the state test wastewater for COVID-19 variants and share information on genomic sequencing of COVID-19 positive tests. The highly mutated strain of the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19 has been making headlines after a March 19th report published by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that said it is monitoring cicada, also called BA.3.2. The World Health Organization is monitoring that new variant, too. "Interest in cicada is high because of the possibility that vaccination or past infection may not provide protection against it. The fall 2025 COVID-19 vaccines were formulated for descendants of the JN1 variant of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. BA.3.2 has distinct lineage from JN1, which could affect how the 2026 vaccines are formulated. We don't have a lot of antibody immunity to this. The most recent CDC estimates show the dominant strain of COVID-19 circulating in the U.S. right now is KFG, known as Stratus, which is an offshoot of JN1. Everything we've been seeing over the last 2 years has been JN1 and versions of JN1, said Engelthayer, who also leads the Infectious Disease Division of the Arizona-based Translational Genomics Research Institute. We don't have a lot of antibody immunity to this BA.3.2 cicada version. Another reason for the heightened interest in cicada could be due to the nickname researchers gave it. The BA.3.2 variant was seen in South Africa in 2024, went dormant for a period, and, like cicada insects, later reappeared. It seems like COVID is a pretty strong marketing team and that they are coming up with clever names for this, Engelthayer said. It really doesn't speak much about this particular virus and how it affects humans, other than because we haven't been seeing it for a while, we really don't have much antibody buildup to that strain. As of March 19th, cicada had been reported in 23 counties and began increasing in prevalence in the United States in September 2025, the CDC report says. Among states nearing Arizona that have detected cicada either through wastewater detection or sequencing are California, Texas, and Utah. BA.3.2 now accounts for 11% of U.S. cases, but it's too early to tell how quickly it's growing, epidemiologist Caitlin Gentlina wrote March 31st in Your Local Epidemiologist, a U.S. public health education newsletter. What is clear is that it is yet to trigger a surge. Wastewater levels, emergency department visits, and hospitalizations all remain low. Historically, a variant doesn't drive a significant new wave until it reaches about 50% of cases, she wrote. Does cicada cause more severe COVID illness? Cicada does not appear to cause more serious illness than any other strain of COVID-19 virus. While the COVID-19 virus is still circulating in Arizona, transmission is at low levels. We don't have any evidence that cicada symptoms really be any different, Engelthayer said. There's nothing really suggesting that. It's still the upper respiratory, sore throat, runny nose, and recommendations if you feel sick, stay home from school, stay home from work. That will help lessen the spread. Cicada is part of the same Omicron family of COVID-19 virus strains that emerged from the pandemic. What that basically means is, meet the new boss, same as the old boss, Engelthayer said, quoting from the song Won't Get Fooled Again by The Who. It's still Omicron, which is still the final version of this virus that came out of this pandemic, which is typically an upper respiratory virus, and why we have much lower severity, lower death rates, etc., than the previous versions before Omicron, Engelthayer said. We're in this kind of almost a parasitic type of relationship, where it's COVID-19 is not going to go away. It's not going to change enough so we can get rid of it with immunity and with vaccines, but it also not killing us in great amounts. Reach healthcare reporter Stephanie Innes at stephanie.innes at usatodayco.com. You can take SunSound with you with our mobile app available for both Android and iPhone. Our next article is titled, Woman Found Dead in Canal with Supportive Presence, Mom Says, by Helen Rummel. Passion Schurz would always be the first to check in on those around her. The mother and eldest daughter of six children would often mill about family reunions, parties, and gatherings, asking about the lives of her family and loved ones, her mother and Leah Anderson recalls. She would just go around the crowd and talk to every person, Anderson said, wanting to lift everyone up. Passion Schurz, or Pash, as her family called her, disappeared on March 19th and was found dead just over a week after she was last seen at her family home. The 28-year-old Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community member was mourned by many in her community in a candlelight vigil earlier this week. Anderson said she was overwhelmed by the support. Seeing that big crowd, I just kind of lost my train of thought, Anderson said. Schurz was on her way to building a better life for herself, her mother said. She was on the cusp of graduating from several life skills courses and working her way to buy a car to have reliable transportation to and from work. She was artistic and described as a resilient inspiration to those around her. Schurz is survived by her mother, several siblings, and two young children. The family is currently raising money on a GoFundMe for funeral expenses and to help provide stability to Schurz's family. An investigation into Schurz's death is ongoing. Her body was found in the Scottsdale Canal on March 28th, with Scottsdale police not finding any injuries related to fractures, stab wounds, or gunshot wounds. Police will continue to investigate Schurz's death and can be contacted at 480-312-5000. Anderson said she wants to make sure detectives get to the bottom of what happened to her daughter after her sudden disappearance in the family's home within the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community. I'm still going to fight through this investigation, she said. Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community President Martin Arviar shared his condolences with Schurz's loved one last month, urging neighbors to unite their efforts around the family. During this difficult time, we encourage the community to come together in care and support for one another, a statement from Arviar said. Please check in on your loved ones, reach out to those who need it, and continue to look out for each other. Anderson said the family expects to hold another vigil for Schurz at the same time next year Do you remember her as a woman who was beautiful both inside and out? Reach the reporter Helen Rummel at HRUMMEL@azcentral.com. We turn to another disquieting mystery with an article titled Officials Found Woman Won't Say What Happened by Jose R. Gonzalez. Christina Marie Plant, a woman found alive after she went missing as a girl in 1994 out of Payson, has declined to further cooperate, according to authorities, who said her mother was initially her suspected abductor. Plant vanished without a trace as a 13-year-old on May 15, 1994, from the Star Valley, Payson, Arizona area, after walking to a horse stable, according to information released by the Gila County Sheriff's Office. The woman was not willing to cooperate with investigators on the circumstances of her disappearance, but provided enough information to confirm she was the missing girl, the Sheriff's Office said April 3rd. She was identified following new leads developed through advances in technology, modern investigative techniques, and detailed case review, the agency said April 1st, after announcing she was found. The Sheriff's Office also revealed on April 3rd that Plant's mother, who the agency said did not have parental custody, was suspected of being her abductor after the teen's uncle reported her missing. At the time, search and rescue workers traced a vehicle allegedly linked to her disappearance to a local hotel, the agency added. Plant was residing within the United States, according to the Sheriff's Office. We wrap Hour 1 with an article titled Tucson House Undergoing Construction for Upgrades by Sarah Lapidus. Location, 1501 North Oracle Road. Description, Tucson is conducting a rehabilitation of Tucson House, a public housing apartment complex. The city will upgrade over 400 units into 358 modern affordable apartment homes for adults ages 55 and older. The complex will feature upgraded systems, new community and amenity spaces, and enhanced outdoor areas. The city said that although units are being reduced at Tucson House, they are being replaced at a greater than 1-to-1 ratio in other development projects. The project is expected to be completed in the summer of 2028. History. Originally built in 1963, the 17-floor Tucson House had ornate lobby doors and stood as the city's tallest building. It was described as a city within the city because of all the amenities it offered, including a limousine service, recreational activities, beauty and barber shops, and an Olympic-sized swimming pool. The building was built along the Miracle Mile, which was a popular stop for travelers driving across the country starting in the 1960s. Motels for fatigued travelers flourished in the area, as did hundreds of other businesses. The area was known for all its billboards and neon signs. That's a wrap for Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Monday, April 6, 2026. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli, thanking you for listening to Hour 1 and encouraging you to stay tuned for Hour 2 and our other great programs here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.